Hello, Kate O'Toole here. It is a busy week in the garden this week. As always, join us live at 6 o'clock on Saturday mornings on ABC Radio Brisbane and Gold Coast to ask your questions. But for now, here are some great tips. Our gardening expert is Annette McFarlane.
Good morning, Kate.
Dale in Caloundra, thank you so much for your call this morning.
Well, good morning, Annette. I have a euphorbia, a crown of thorns, and it's been in the ground and it's grown in the sun, I think, too much. And it's grown to a 14-inch stalk with a few leaves on top.
Mm-hmm.
Can I cut it off? Like, is it, if I cut it off, would it regrow again or what?
Well, sometimes it does, but you've got to be careful that that doesn't rot. So the best thing to do is to, if you can, cut it back to a point that is branching rather than, you know, just take the top out of it. But, I mean, if you really want to try and make it bush, then, yeah, you can take the risk, if you like, of pruning it and hopefully it'll shoot from, you know, the base of the plant or lower down for you. Just make sure you try and protect that cut surface in some way. And sometimes people put a little bit of powdered sulfur on it so that that cut stem is not going to rot during all the rain that is predicted. But, you know, sometimes they do have that habit of growing tall and a bit spindly.
Yeah, it's just a stalk. It doesn't have any branches or anything out of it. It's just a stalk with half a dozen leaves on top.
Well, what I'd do is cut it in half, hope that the bottom bit grows, but plant the top bit anyway, just as an insurance policy. How's that?
And the top part will grow then, will it?
It will, yes, that's right.
Thank you so much, Dale.
Thank you.
And from Nunda, g'day.
Hello.
You are thinking about your hedge.
I know Morayas are boring, but, Annette, I just wondered, I sent in a photo where there are two struggling Morayas.
Mm-hmm.
The soil pH was not right when I planted them, so I've since, you know, got the kit, changed it all up. Would I cut back to try and get them bushy? Will I pull them out and start again?
I would just cut them back and feed them. You know, they've often struggled, even though Morayas are really tough. They struggle when it's really, really dry and also when they're in a shaded situation. So it does look like your plants are a little bit crowded out by other things.
Yeah.
So that's why they've tended to grow, you know, tall and a bit leggy. So if you could prune some of the other things around them to try and give them a bit more sunlight, but otherwise just feed them up and you trim them back. And with all this rain, they should shoot away really quickly.
Okay, terrific. Thanks so much. And it's raining.
It is.
Hooray.
Yes. Good on you, Anne. Anne from Nunda.
Bye.
Pete in Cedar Grove, your dog's a vegetarian.
Well, yeah, although the little buggers just started taking a fancy to one of our hibiscus, you know, hibiscus. I'm just wondering, is there any nutritional value in the leaves?
Well, hibiscus leaves are quite edible. I mean, you could eat them and it wouldn't, you know, do you any harm. I don't know that they're that particularly palatable. I guess the worry is, why is the dog eating them? Is it, you know, sometimes they get fixated on one plant in the garden. And I guess it's just a dangerous habit to encourage with dogs. I mean, you could talk to your local vet about perhaps what you could do to discourage it. But I'd be worried that if the dog starts doing that, then it will go and actually do that to other plants in the garden. So maybe some people often put a big patch of lemongrass, for example, and the dogs will often come and chew on that. So sometimes dogs do sort of feed on grasses and that. I haven't heard them eating hibiscus leaves, but my worry would be that it had moved to other things in the garden if it gets into that habit that aren't actually good for it.
So, Pete, I thought you were worried about your hibiscus. You're worried about your dog?
No, don't worry about the hibiscus.
Okay, you are.
No. So I would just think about, you know, what can you do to keep the dog away? I mean, the hibiscus will take being chewed, but so think about, can you distract the dog in some other way or put a barrier up at least temporarily? And so I'm worried about the health of the dog and what else it's going to eat in the garden. Might start on the hibiscus, but if you've got a full-blown vegetarian, it might move to everything else.
Peter from Cedar Grove there, and the very tasty hibiscus at his place. Scott, g'day.
Hello, how are you this morning?
Very well. What's happening at your place?
Look, my question, is deadwooding like roses and vines and things?
Mm-hmm.
Every time it's a spectacular result, but I just don't understand why it makes such a result.
Oh, okay. Well, it depends on the plant that you're talking about. So some plants flower on new growth. So with roses, for example, that's why we prune them on a regular basis, because you prune them, you feed them, it produces new growth. The more new growth, the more blooms that you get. So it depends on the plant that you're talking about. So things like camellias flower on older wood. So you have to at least have pruned them, say, about a year beforehand, and then you'll get good flowers. But with something, you know, we're talking about hibiscus or with roses or things like that, they flower on new wood. So when you prune them, you feed them, they produce new growth immediately, and that's why you suddenly get all those blooms.
Yeah, but it's more the effect of just, like, not actually pruning the bush itself, but just deadwooding it, and it just seems to have an enormous effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, any dead wood, you've got to ask yourself, why is there so much dead wood in there?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
of course, that also has the potential to create disease. So even just cleaning the plants out of any of those old sticks and twigs and dead wood in there just even improves the look of the plant. And so the plant's more, I guess, then encouraged to put new growth on, and that's why you get such a good response. So it's not trying to fight off and stop the disease in that dead wood penetrating down further into the plant. But, so it's a good idea to clean out that dead wood on a regular basis. And those things that flower on new wood, we prune regularly.
Oh, I see, yeah. So it just gets more energy to put into producing.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Look, thank you very much. It's been bugging me for a long time, and now I have the answer.
Okay, thanks, Scott.
And that's what it's like. Thank you so much, Scott. Nick from Annerley, what are you hoping to grow?
I'm hoping to grow hellebores. I've spent a bit of money on getting some seed up from Tasmania, and then I just wonder, will they grow in Brisbane? And if so, what should I do to make the best of them?
Oh, look, if I say they won't grow, there'll be someone out there that rings in and says, I've got one that's blooming, but it's very difficult. I mean, I love hellebores. I grew up in Melbourne, and they were one of my favourite plants. I used to care for a lot of them when I worked
in
the park.
What are they?
Oh, you often see them on the television in cold climate plants. They're a woodland plant that normally would grow underneath trees and that sort of thing. They have really lovely foliage to them, but then they come out with these flowers. I don't know, they're quite a simple flower, but just beautiful, often in mauve colours and autumn tones and that sort of thing. I mean, they're just,
So he needs the opposite of a greenhouse. He needs something that'll make it cooler and drier.
A cooler, less humid sort of environment. So if you had a shade house, that would be the best.
I'm on top of a hill which gets, you know, quite a lot of breezes, and I've got a grove of crepe myrtles, which I thought might sort of recreate that situation.
I don't know how they're going to go in the ground, to be honest, because they're not used to having, you know, 100 millimetres of rain on them. So my worry would be the summer rainfall. So that's why I'm thinking pots might be better in a shade house.
Okay.
Or even just pots in the shade, somewhere on a veranda or a very protected spot away from strong winds, because normally, remember, they'd be down at ground level, the shade of trees, and cool, humid conditions perhaps, but not hot, humid conditions.
All right, I'll give it a go and let you know.
Okay, that'd be great.
Thank you. All the best, Nick. Thank you so much for that. Just thinking in the last couple of weeks where we've had really hot temperatures and it's been snowing down south, like the temperature variation that you'd be expecting the plants to cope with on their normal climate would be pretty huge. G'day, John in Fernie Hills. How are you going this morning?
Good. And yourself?
Not too bad. You're trying to get rid of some bamboo.
My neighbour down the back's got a grove.
Mm-hmm.
Bamboo, and I seem to have a lot of fibrous root in the garden adjacent.
Yep.
Would that be normal for the bamboo?
Oh, yes. The root system is very extensive, and so it'll go metres and metres beyond the plant itself, and it's a very fibrous root system. You can't grow anything really, in that area. You'd be forced, I'd say, to perhaps put things, you know, put bark down and put pots or something, very difficult to get things to establish. And really, there's not a lot you can do about it unless the neighbour wants to remove the bamboo. You get a trenching machine in or something like that and cut the roots out, put compost and soil back in, but the root system from the bamboo, unless you put a barrier, some sort of physical barrier, is going to still grow through. So some people put tin, like corrugated iron, sunk down into the soil to form a bit of a barrier. But yeah, the roots do extend quite a long way, and it's really like a thick mat, so it's quite difficult to grow anything.
And is it a noxious plant in Queensland?
It would depend on the type of bamboo that you've got. So check what the... So Fernie Hills, you're still in Brisbane. Not to my understanding, I don't think it is, but you might like to have a conversation with your neighbour. They may be just, you know, unaware of what they can do about it, and it probably would be a case, if they wanted to get rid of it, is bringing a bit of machinery in, really, is the most cost-effective way. So, you know, hiring a bobcat for a couple of hours to come in and take the whole lot out is really probably your best option, because any of the chemical options are very slow and take a long time, and then you're still left with all the mess to clean up anyway. So, so I'd have a chat to them and see if you can come to some sort of resolution.
Okay, I did have a second question, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a kaffir lime tree, which I bought as, and it's growing, and it's got a lot of fruit on it.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it originally for the leaves, which I previously purchased at Woolworths to go into curries.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in your culinary experience that you can do with the lime plant?
Some of them are quite... The limes are quite juicy on the kaffir lime, so you can still squeeze that and use the juice. People often use the zest of the lime. In the same way you would use the zest of a lemon. I've known people to also make marmalade out of kaffir limes as well. And traditionally in Southeast Asia, they cut them up in the fruit in half or quarters and put them in bowls and use them as a room deodorizer. So there, if you've got a massive crop, that's what you can do.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Margaret is in Kalanga. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Annette. I was reading in Grassroots, which I normally read, about fruit sucking bug.
Mm-hmm.
They say to squash up a banana and mm-hmm. put it in a stocking with some poison. Now, what sort of poison would I put in?
Well, I don't know what they're suggesting in that magazine. Some people put, and I was talking about this to actually the fruit growing guru in Peter Young. I had the pleasure of his company last Saturday at lunchtime, and he was actually saying some of the callers that rang in, he thinks their avocados with spots on them were suffering from fruit sucking bugs. So anthracnose is often a problem in that, but apparently up on the Sunshine Coast particularly, and, you know, Kalanga, maybe they're migrating down to you, Margaret. These bugs are in plague proportions, causing commercial avocados to, you know, growers to lose all their crops. So they're terrible bugs. And some people, yes, do use bananas as traps, but rather than putting a poison in the bananas, I guess, I don't know what you would put in there. Maybe if they're feeding on it, even just something like a pyrethrum mixed in would do the job.
Yeah,
but what they're doing,
they say they like the banana.
They do, yeah. So, but yeah, mashed bananas or that sort of thing hanging in a stocking. But the suggestion that was given to me is some people make like a teepee covered in shade cloth with an entrance that the bugs can get in underneath, and it works with fruit sucking moths as well. And so they're attracted to it, the banana inside, they become trapped in the teepee because they don't fly out of the top. You seal the top up, so they come in underneath, and in the morning you go out and they're all there and you squash them. But you know, maybe mix. I'd try mixing it with a pyrethrum and see how you get on. It'd be interesting to see how effective it is. But if you're getting things that look like fruit fly spots on fruit in the garden. It can be fruit sucking bugs or fruit piercing moths. So, yeah, terrible problem out there, particularly on the Sunshine Coast.
Oh, yes. Okay, then. Do you know anything about desert limes?
Yes, I've tried to grow one and it died.
Well, I bought my daughter, I thought it was a finger lime, but it's turned out to be a desert lime. It's got these little marbles around. And, they're terribly sour. I don't know what to do with them.
Oh, you're doing better than me. Well, they come from Central Australia and they're native. And they're, I imagine there's quite a lot of recipes as to how to use them. But often these are used as like a sauce on the side of a dish or some sort of flavouring rather than as we would use other limes because, the flavour is quite strong, as is a lot of flavours in, local native bush foods.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your call, Margaret.
Okay, thanks.
All the best. I hope you can catch some of those pesky bugs. Good morning, Dennis.
Yes, good morning, ladies. Just a problem with composting.
What's going on?
I've got the black composting bin. I busily put in scraps and grass cuttings and twigs and things, but I make up a lovely mix and then put it on the garden, and then like a vegetable garden comes up automatically. I can't seem to. I've got pumpkins and
tomatoes
and things going berserk. So I just can't seem to kill off the seeds.
Okay, well, it's your composting method that you're using. So those bins are really a cold composting method, is how they naturally work. And so they don't heat up enough to kill those sorts of seeds. Now, most people would think that's a bonus. I'd be quite happy to pull out a few pumpkins and tomatoes and that sort of thing. But if it worries you, you could try just putting more blood and bone or those pelletized chicken manure or something like that in between all the layers of your compost. So you're trying to create more nitrogen so that the compost heats up to a greater extent, but it's just a bit more difficult in those bins if you don't turn the compost. So if you're just filling it up, gradually the air goes out of that material and so you get an anaerobic conditions rather than aerobic conditions.
I do turn it a bit. I've got a spade with a long hand.
Yeah, you really need to have two bins.
Just turn it over, you know.
Yeah, you really need to have two bins and take it out of one bin completely and put it into the other bin and swap it back and forth is the better way. But as I say, put some blood and bone. So every time you put material in, put a handful of blood and bone in there, and that will heat the compost up so that you get less of those things germinating. But, you know, even tomatoes, you'll still get those coming up probably because they love that composting process. It actually initiates the germination of the seed.
Right. So I was going to ask how hot it needs to get, but it depends on the seed.
Yeah, at least 55 degrees, which is basically hotter than you can put your hand in, 55 degrees C.
Good morning, Margaret.
Oh, good morning. Thank you, ladies, for taking my call. I've got a problem. I've got a large Bismarck in my front garden.
Yes.
And in the last 10 days, it's dropped 12 green fronds.
Oh, dear. From the centre or from the bottom?
No, they seem to be just falling off the bark, the trunk of the tree.
Okay. And what's happened to this plant over the last few years, Margaret?
Well, it's been there for about 12 or 15 years and it's nothing really. It's just been a rather lovely specimen in my garden. And
okay.
10 days ago, I think 5 came down and then next day was another 3.
Okay. And there's been no changes to levels in the soil or no driveways or buildings or anything
put in? Nothing.
And have you been very dry at Palm Woods?
Yes, we have. And actually, the first lot fell just the day before we had that storm about Thursday a week ago or so. Mm.
So it might be just a build-up of stress from the dryness, and then sometimes what happens is when we do get rain, you do see this drop of fronds as the plant tries and put lots of new growth on. So that may be happening. I'd be really concerned if it's the new growth because you can get diseases that affect that, crown of palms that cause them to die off. So, yeah, just keep an eye on it, but not a lot you can do, really.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
on ABC Radio Brisbane and Queensland, this is Kate O'Toole.
It is, and you're in luck because Annette McFarlane is here too. It's time to wonder about the garden. Ferris from Main Beach, g'day.
Hey, g'day. My problem is threefold. I've got a lemon tree that seems to have bunches of flowers on it, but it doesn't fruit, or only very occasionally. And it also gets these little white moths on it that are so annoying.
Okay. So what are the little white moths doing?
Well, they multiply very rapidly.
Okay.
And put a little bit of gluey stuff on the stalks.
Oh, all right.
And then the store, the new flower or the new leaf dies.
Okay. So we might be talking about something like, whitefly there on those. So the thing with lemon trees is they will always produce more flowers than will set fruit. So it's sort of like their insurance policy, but there are a few things that you can do to make sure that you get as much fruit as possible, and that primarily is keeping the water and nutrition up to them. So in the garden, we put fertiliser on every season. So summer, autumn, winter, spring, I always put fertiliser on my fruit trees. And if you're growing them in pots, then you need to put it on much more regularly. So about every 6 weeks. So you could even say every once a month, you could put a little bit of fertiliser, of a fruit tree fertiliser, onto pots and water them really well. And large pots generally in the hot weather that we've been having need watering every single day. And if you let them dry out, of course, they won't set the fruit. Now, when it comes to pest and disease problems, the easiest thing to use is an oil spray, and that will, you know, cope with really most of the pests that affect lemons. So just a simple oil spray. Now that it's going to be cooler and getting a bit of rain, it's the perfect time to apply it, and that should help control those little moth problems you're having. So make sure you spray on the undersides of the leaves, and if you do that every couple of months, that should keep that problem under control for you.
Okay, fine. The other thing, on the mandarin tree, I've got this about a centimetre long black insect that's very, very fast. You try and catch it and it shoots off. And it seems to live along the stems of it.
Oh, okay. So again, any of the oil sprays, you could use that. It'll often act as both a deterrent and also kill the insect there. Whether or not that insect is doing him any damage, I don't know. I'd have to get a closer look at something to identify it. But just try the oil spray and the nutrition and regular watering. I'm sure you'll get an improvement in those plants.
Okay. Last of all, as my tomatoes seem to get a triangular little green insect on there, like a beetle.
Oh, yes, I know. They're green vegetable bugs, terrible things. What I do with my tomatoes is I put bags over them, so a paper bag and a peg tightly sealed around the top of the tomato as soon as it sets. And if I see any of those green vegetable bugs, I squash them immediately. So put a pair of gloves on, go out there and do a regular patrol each day and squash them. They're smelly and disgusting, but that keeps them under control.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I planted 3 passion fruit vines about 12 months ago. No fruit yet. How long should I wait for fruit? What hints can you give me?
Okay, so probably it's just the dryness that we've had. So passion fruit, commercial growers get them to bear within 6 months. Most home gardeners take 12 months. Your next opportunity for flowering should be soon, and hopefully you'll get a crop maybe in, it's probably a bit late for a March crop, so you might have to wait until September. But you do get 2 crops a year. Just make sure that you're putting a good fruit tree fertiliser, the full extent of the growth of the vines. So not just around the place where the stem goes into the ground, but wherever there's foliage, basically that means there's a root system. And so fertilise them well with a fruit tree fertiliser and really keep the water up to them. You should get some flowers soon, and hopefully March or April you'll be picking passion fruit. And if you've got three vines, that will be a lot of passion fruit.
So if you're training the vine like along a fence,
yes,
you put the fertiliser along the length of the fence, or do you mean Absolutely. Like in a circle as with the diameter of the length of the what you've trained?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Obviously the plants just don't go
in a straight line,
but the idea is to try and spread the fertilizer around as much as you possibly can, because most people think that the root system is right where the stem is, but of course it isn't. It extends the full extent of the foliage. So that's why you spread the fertilizer out. And the same thing with your watering. Mm. If you've just got a dripper that goes dripping on that near the stem, it's not watering the root system effectively.
I see. And could you suggest a fertiliser that might be of particular benefit?
Oh, look, any of the fruit tree ones, they're all good. I usually go for what's on special at the time and then swap them around. So you can change different brands if you like. But you need something, you know, a citrus fertiliser is perfect for passion fruit.
All right. And no advantage in pruning? Pruning wouldn't achieve anything, would it? Pruning the vine?
And the only thing you're trying to do in pruning is to help you train the vine. So remember, when you do get flowers, if the vine is really, really thick and all grown over itself, you won't get good pollination because the bees won't be able to get into those flowers. And also, if the vine's not trained, then you'll find that you get a lot of disease problems, particularly when we get the rain. So that's why you're trying to train them along a trellis or a fence or something like that, rather than let them grow just like a mass all over one another.
And Sonia is on the line from Nambour. Good morning.
Good morning, Kate and Annette. I'm a bit concerned about the rain that's coming. We've had heavy showers in Nambour overnight. I have quite a lot of succulents in pots, normally in the sunny places. How will I cope now with the large amounts of rain expected? Mm. Should I shift them undercover?
If you could shift them undercover, that would be a good idea. If they're smaller pots and you've got some buckets, sometimes you can just put a bucket over the top of them. But you're right to be concerned about lots and lots of rain on those succulents, those pots, because it's not so bad if you get one day of rain, but they're predicting rain on and off for the next 2 weeks. And up at Nambour and just the Sunshine Coast generally has had quite a lot of rain already. So if it's possible for you to move them, yes, I would shift them undercover or throw a tarp over the top of them, or as long as you can really
weigh it down.
But if you've got a few pots and it's easy enough to move them, then I would move them to a more sheltered position.
Sounds like I'm going to get a bit of exercise.
It does indeed. Good on you, Sonia. Yeah.
Or call in a friend. Thank you so much, Sonia. Nona from Chinchilla, good morning.
Good morning.
How can we help you this morning?
What was your question this morning? Yeah.
Well, I have some insects that they look like lady beetles, but they've got stripes and they're very, very quick on at moving around.
And what are they on?
Well, they, first of all, they were on the, what do you call that lily, the funeral lily.
Okay, yep.
And now they've sort of moved all more like, we're very dry here. We only got 2 mils of rain yesterday.
Right.
So the place isn't lush.
Mm-hmm.
But they're on the jasmine sambuca. I've got a duca.
Oh, yeah.
And I've also got the Chinese emperor.
Okay. And do you think they're doing any damage?
Well, I don't know. There's so much damage in the garden.
Yep, it's hard to tell whether it's there.
To be concerned about them, because I think one even bit me.
Oh, okay. All right.
It was a little black ant, and I sort of brushed it, my leg, and one of those things flew off, so.
Yeah. Well, there are certainly different types of lady beetles around, and the ones that we normally worry about are the ones that have lots and lots of spots on the back of them. Yeah, so they're the worst ones. A lot of the others are often ones that actually eat powdery mildew and other things like that. So you get them on, your pumpkins and cucumbers and that type of thing, and they're actually beneficial. But there are lots and lots of leaf eating beetles, particularly ones that will get on tomatoes and potato crops or anything that's related to that family. The thing is, to control them is quite difficult. Usually it's just a case of squashing them by hand. But if you've been, you know, if you've been bitten by them, you better make sure that you've got your gloves on. I'd suggest, though, perhaps when you do get some more rain, hopefully chinchilla and everywhere else out there is in line for more than just a couple of mils, that they'll probably disappear of their own accord. But there certainly are lots of beetles that look like what we'd call lady beetles, but are different species and actually do eat plants. So it may be that you do have to bring about some control on them. But I'd probably wait until you see if you get some rain, and it's likely that the foliage will really recover and it won't be an issue for you.
They were in the arum lily for a start.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I would say there would be a couple of hundred there.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gradually spread all over the yard.
Yeah, and sometimes, though, what happens with those things is they come through in waves. So there are a number of different beetles that will come through your garden, and they're just seasonal, and then they'll move on. So once the conditions change, I think they'll probably be fine. And particularly when you're getting them in like a plague proportion like that, tends to indicate that the conditions have just been right for them to really take off. So, you know, if you're concerned about particular plants, you could try, you know, spraying with a pyrethrum or drenching the plants with molasses, so molasses and water. I'm sure you've got plenty of that out there at Chinchilla. So a tablespoon of molasses into a litre of water, and you could actually you put that in a watering can and water it over the tops of your plants, and that may give them a bit of protection.
Meriden from Sunnybank, g'day.
Hello.
Hello, what was your question?
Yes, I have quite a large vegetable garden, but I've given up trying to grow things in summer because with the heat it just all wilts very quickly. And I'm wondering, is there any point in me putting soil improver into the soil during this time, or will it have broken down by the time, you know, the cooler weather comes again?
I think there's always an advantage of putting a soil improver in, but of course compost is your best, you know, and most reliable soil improver rather than one that you're just going to buy in a bag from, you know, a big box store. So as much compost as you can. And when you say you don't have success in summertime, that really depends on what you choose to grow. So you need to be very careful about the varieties of things that you put in. So pumpkins and cucumbers and, you know, some lettuce varieties all do really well. It's all about the choices that you make. But if you're trying to grow things like tomatoes, well, they're hopeless in our summer, particularly when we get the rainfall. But if you choose carefully, you can get things to grow in the summer. But any compost that you can put in at any time is going to be beneficial.
Yes, and unbelievably, the things I have success with are the cherry tomatoes.
Cherry tomatoes are not too bad, but it's when people try to grow big tomatoes. So yeah, if you throw a few cherry tomatoes, it doesn't even have to be in the vegetable garden, just coming up everywhere. The only thing is my hens and ducks tend to find them before I do. That's my problem. Good on you, Meriden.
Thank you so much, Meriden. Barbara in Pacific Pines. Good morning, Barbara.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. I had some large macarangas cut down in the front garden in September.
Yep.
And now I've got a massive regrowth from all over the garden where the shoots are just coming up all from the roots.
Yep.
So I didn't want to poison them, and I was going to try Epsom salts. Is there a way I can get rid of these?
Not with Epsom salts, you won't, because that's going to be like a fertiliser to them. So the problem with the macarangas is, yes, when you do cut them, they do tend to sucker. So the root system needs to be removed. So when you had the tree taken out, I'm not sure whether they ground the root system, but wherever the root system is left in the soil, it will provide a source of nutrients for those suckers to regrow. So unfortunately, you're left with just continuously pulling them out or actually grubbing out the root system. So it's, you know, if you're not going to treat it in any other ways, the Epsom salts won't make any difference, I'm afraid.
Okay.
So all right.
Continuously pull them out or revert to, so if I was to poison them, then what would I use, like a glyphosate?
Well, you could probably try any of the, you know, there are other herbicides in the market that anything that's like a lawn fertiliser would work, a lawn herbicide would work, so it doesn't have to be Roundup glyphosate. Any of those other types of herbicides that are on the market would work. But otherwise, as I say, if you can grub along the lines of the root system, then that will get rid of it.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thanks, indeed. Bye now.
Alfred from the Bay Islands. G'day.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for your patience there. What did you want to ask Annette this morning?
I have two fig trees. One's a black Tenaya, one's a turkey brown. The turkey brown is in its own shade house and its leaves are curling. The horticulturist looked at it. There was no signs of insects at all. I can't work out why. I've turned around and put Searle's black magic fertiliser around the drip line.
Right.
And so forth. But and watered it in,
yep.
But still no signs of the leaves uncurling.
Mm, okay, so sometimes, even though you can't see the insects, it's possible that you've got a mite issue, or if someone's had a really close look at it with a hand lens, it can also be disease issues which will cause leaf curling on figs, so particularly the early stages of things like rust diseases. So I think my approach would be to use a fungicide on it, and I'd probably use a copper spray and spraying it on the undersides of the leaves. Sometimes, if it's in its own pot in a protected area and there's too much humidity, remember they need that dryness, so I'd be tending to move it out where it's going to get perhaps a bit more air circulation around it and see how that goes. But I'd certainly be treating it with a copper spray because I think you've probably got the early signs of a rust disease.
Thank you so much, Alfred, for your call about your fig. A few text messages in as well. Margaret wondering about a poinsettia that she got for Christmas and planted in the garden, and it grew to a metre, looked well, but only had green leaves after that.
Okay.
What about the Christmas colours? What happened to the Christmas colours?
Well, of course, that's a bit of a trick, isn't it? So our very talented nursery people alter the light exposure of plants in order to make poinsettias flower at Christmas time. So they will never flower in the garden at Christmas time. They flower in winter. So just leave your plant alone. You can lightly trim it, in January, and you'll have a beautiful display in winter. Time.
Christmas in July.
Yeah.
At your place.
Never in December.
Thanks, Margaret from Wynnum. Russell in Carina Heights asking about the best pH for baby bougainvillea.
Oh, about 6.5 should be fine.
Melinda has a mandarin tree that's 4 years old, a couple of metres tall, pest-free, healthy, never flowered. Is she too impatient or she needs to hang on?
Maybe.
Or?
Usually by 4 years, if it's had good nutrition, just watch you're not overdoing the nitrogen fertiliser on it. But otherwise, you just got to be patient. I'd try a bit of trace elements instead as part of your normal fertiliser routine.
Sharon has a 45-year-old desert rose that she's sawn most of the root system off because of root rot. She's placed some rooting hormone on, repotted in a small pot. Any chances of survival for this vintage plant?
There is always the Christmas miracle, isn't there? So keep your fingers crossed.
Thank you so much, Sharon. And thank you so much to Annette McFarlane for being our gardening expert once again. My name's Kate O'Toole. And if you'd like to ask a question about your garden, make sure you listen live from 6 o'clock on Saturday morning on ABC Radio Brisbane and Gold Coast.